Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
Day spring, come in your wisdom, save us from ourselves, Jesus, come in your weakness, bring hope to all the world, bring hope to all the world.
Scripture this morning comes out of the book of Isaiah, 9th chapter, and I'm going to read the first 4 verses. But there will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shined. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian.
Everywhere I go,
I spent the summer in Managua, Nicaragua, after I graduated from college, and my Spanish was good enough to get in trouble, but not good enough to get out of trouble. So I spent time in the mornings with teachers, and then in the afternoon, I would find my way every single day to my real Spanish teachers, kids that were on the street, and we played baseball together. I remember getting there, and I brought with me all of my unconscious expectations of baseball here. I was from the Midwest in Kansas City and went to college in Iowa, and what I assumed was that everybody had their bag, and in it you had not just like your one glove, but in case you went to a different position, you had a second glove, and some of us even carried like 3 gloves, and you had your bat, and it was shiny and new and aluminum and light, and then you had lots of baseballs. And I got there, and met kids where we would share enough gloves almost for us to all have one when we were out in the field, which was the street, not the nicely mowed grass that we had in Kansas City. And the bat, well, there was a bat, and it was all banged up. It had been tossed on the street more times than you can imagine. And we had the balls would, as we would get into the night, like you, at home you could play because the lights came on, right? But down there, the ball was so dark that it would get harder to see as the night would set in. The gulf between our worlds was tremendous. We were playing the same game, but it felt really, really different. For those young brown-skinned kids who welcomed me onto the street to play the American game, I remember walking home with them in the dark, and that's where Spanish got real, as we would walk home together. And then I returned after that summer to Minneapolis, and Sarah and I lived together in an intentional Christian community in Minneapolis called the Community of St. Martin. And we did things that most folks would say is kind of crazy in the church world. People live together in a house. Like, we have our kitchen tables that come together once a week. But we all live together. Folks would share cars. Folks would intentionally work part-time so that we could devote the rest of our time to building community together. One of the things that we did was go every year from Minneapolis down to Fort Benning, Georgia. And Fort Benning was the home of what then was called the U.S. Army School of the Americas. And so we would get on a bus, and we would go all the way down. And we were going there to rise up, to share our voices, because those kids right there, their families, had been brutally repressed by the people that we were training to go down to Central America. And so we wanted to shift those policies that we had and say, let's devote that to making peace rather than to hurting the folks that are just wanting to have enough baseball gloves in Managua to play catch. So about 40 of us would get on the bus and we'd make our way down, and then we would get up early in the morning. And we joined a funeral procession. I know some of you have been down there in the past, and that's what it looked like. So the folks there are all holding crosses with names on them. And so some of those names are famous people, like Archbishop Oscar Romero. And some of them are folks we've never heard of. And some just says, unknown child 7. And as you get close to the base, what happens is you hear the names of people being read out loud. And everyone just says, presente. Their spirit is present with us. And I remember walking to that line that separates the base from the rest of us. And you get there and everybody starts to place the crosses, the Stars of David, right there in the fence. And it becomes like just this enormous memorial ground, remembering the names of those folks. And most of us would go through, and the organizers had worked together with the military so that when we would come onto the base, we would be arrested, and then you'd have like a couple hours on a bus, and then you'd come back, and our group would gather. And some folks among us felt called to go deeper than that. So they believed that God was calling them to an even more radical form of civil disobedience. And so they would be arrested, and then they would have to stay for trial. And my friend Steve spent almost a year there in prison. And it was there that I kind of came to consciousness about what it looks like in witnessing other people to try to figure out, what does solidarity mean today? Like, what does it mean to stand with folks who, it's not that they don't have voices. Those kids on the streets were plenty loud. We just didn't have a capacity to hear those voices. And so I learned a lot about that. And then also started to wonder about, as Steve went in and with these old nuns, they were always in their 80s and 90s, they were awesome, and they would go into to prison themselves, and they would be in ministry in that space. And it started to raise up the same kind of questions about how we use prisons today in our culture and in our system. And what I remember most is Steve being left behind, and we're all getting on the bus, and the sun's going down. It's nighttime in Georgia, and we're going back, and it's raining really loud, and our community worshiped together in the evening, and we sang together this thing that's called Holden Evening Vespers. And we didn't plan anything. The sun is down, and it's raining, and somebody just somewhere on the bus starts to sing out, "Jesus Christ, you're the light of the world." And everybody starts to sing along, "The light no darkness can overcome. Stay with us now, for it's evening, and the day is almost over. Let your light scatter the darkness and shine within your people here." And those words amidst the quiet of that moment are maybe one of the most profound experiences of grace that I've ever encountered in my life. And on some level, it's that moment that pushed me to take off from Minneapolis and to go to seminary in New York City. I went to my very first class. It was an introduction to liberation theology with a man named Dr. James Cohn. And it happened to meet just after 9 a.m. on Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. And every once in a while still, to this day, I have these moments where I'm reminded of the nights that followed that. The seminary students would gather together, and because we were seminary students, they would hand us these, they were very nicely printed. They would have your name on it, and it would say, like, seminary intern. And it was your pass to go down past the barricades at Ground Zero. And it looked very much like you knew what you were doing if you had one of these on. And it really masked the truth that, like, now, or much less then, had no clue what I was walking into. But every once in a while, I have these moments, however ill-prepared I was to stand there at night with those first responders, I have these moments that, like, take me back, and I can physically, like, smell what it was like to be down there at nighttime, and we'd be there all through the night. And the anguish and the dread of that came back to me just about a year ago. It came back to me, and it often does, like when I least expected it. It was between the candlelight Christmas Eve worship gatherings right here. It's like one of my very favorite ways we come together as a community. And between those services, our musicians and our families come together at our house, and we have this fabulous meal, and Mark and Sarah cook, and it's incredible. And right before I went back at 11, my partner Sarah stopped me, and she says, she's having another miscarriage. And so we'd been through this a number of times, those dark night of the soul moments, but never before had we done it when you're supposed to go and, like, light candles to say that God is being born in the vulnerability to this unwed teen girl in the middle of nowhere, and let's all light candles to place our hope in that. And the truth is that I just felt like suffocating in this space as we came together in the midst of that, and I needed you all to light some candles because I couldn't figure out how to do that myself. And it's in that kind of feeling that the reading that Linda shared from Isaiah, that is the kind of feeling I believe the people had that Isaiah was speaking into. They were in what's described as a land of deep darkness. And this story comes to us about 700 years before Jesus. The prophet Isaiah looks out at the people, and this again is before Jesus comes into the world as what we would claim as the light of the world. And Isaiah sees that these folks have been overwhelmed by a foreign empire. They are destitute and hungry. They're a land without hope. And the writings of Isaiah, a lot of people describe it this way, and I think it's worthy of all of us hearing it. The writing of Isaiah and all the other prophets in scripture that we find, they're maybe best described as survival literature of a war-torn community. See, these letters were written for families like the kids I was playing baseball with on the street. They were written for folks that could smell what I was smelling there on after in the days or nights after September 11th. They're written for folks that were feeling like we felt when we were supposed to light candles of hope. And I think it's in part why Linda and I wanted to root this series in the life and the teachings and the reflection of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, because it feels to us like the profound hope that can be found in this ancient wisdom might be a little bit more accessible to us if we can try to see it through the lens of a person that might be a little more contemporary. And Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran pastor who rose in a resistance movement in his day in Germany to try to offer a voice of hope to a people that felt destitute as well. But to go back to Isaiah longed for the people not to despair. It wasn't that he said those things didn't happen. It's not like just light the candle and ignore it. Isaiah acknowledged the depth of the experience that the people were in and said, we've walked through darkness and a great light is coming. This is Isaiah's old way of saying it. So hear these words. But there will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. And so this is like the before and the after. It's that moment that I was just describing of anguish that God brought them through this time. And in the latter time, he'll make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. And so what's happened, people wonder here, like, so who is this he? In Isaiah's day, he's saying, like, this is happening, a leader is coming up. And some people read this like as a person is being raised up. But the Hebrew is ambiguous. It might be like an era. There was this era of darkness, and there is this era of light that is coming. And we find ourselves in the tension of that space. And people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in the land of deep darkness, on them light has shined. And then he continues, you've multiplied the nation. You've increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. And he's hearkening back to things that we might not understand, but he's reminding them like, this isn't new. We've been through this before, people. We've done this, and God was with us, and God is with us, and everything is going to be all right. As Julian just sang. See, this person ushers us in. It's long before Jesus. And the people in Isaiah's day were longing for, like, who is this Messiah? And we look back on this text and we read Jesus through this lens and say, he is the one that shows us light. Give light and people will find the way, civil rights activist Ella Baker says. That's what Jesus does for us, we say. Is he gives that light to help us find our way. That's what happens in this story as light shines and it makes glorious the way of the sea, it says. The way of the sea is no like smooth sailing thing. Think of the roughness of the sea, the waves crashing, the dark depths of what that sea is. Jesus becomes the one for us in whom we see that light and find our way. And this is in contrast to the light coming to us from the foreign emperor. Like, that was an option. Like, just settle in, folks. Resistance is futile. Just settle in and see the light for what it is. It won't even be found, though, in our efforts, like our own efforts. It's not like, wow, the people rose up and they did such a great job. Look at them go. It's that God is doing a new thing in this very space. Josh Garrell sings about it. It's going to be all right. Shake it out and let back in the light. Joy will come like a bird in the morning sun. One biblical scholar a number of years ago says it in a way that I find prophetic. In a social context in which kings and rulers wielded almost unlimited power over the lands, lives, and livelihoods of conquered peoples, this insistence on God as the ultimate power reframes political relationships. No longer do political rulers have final say. God's hope, God's sovereignty trumps theirs. So where might folks this day who feel conquered see light, see God? When pundits and prognosticators would have us believe that political leaders have final say, where might we see God's light showing up or showing us otherwise? And so Bonhoeffer is one of the places that I go to try to find my way in the midst of that. He lived in a time in which people around him were placing their hope not in God, but in a single leader. And in the land of that deep darkness, Bonhoeffer found light in places that I hope might guide us and that certainly are least expected among a lot of people. Bonhoeffer writes from prison, and he says, "It's not the religious act that makes the Christian, but participation in the sufferings of God in the secular life." So life together for Bonhoeffer, like the light of God, we find our way, we see our way as we enter into the depths of the suffering of God's people. That's what he calls costly discipleship. It's meeting God in the suffering of our neighbors, and it's not what most of us expect when we turn to Christianity. This isn't like we were with a person this week, the president of Pacific School Religion said, the depth of our tradition doesn't really offer us chicken soup for the soul. It calls us to a revolutionary love. Bonhoeffer describes it this way. God lets God's self be pushed out of the world onto the cross. God is weak and powerless in the world. And that's precisely the way, the only way in which God is with us and helps us. The Bible makes quite clear that Christ helps us not by virtue of God's omnipotence, but by virtue of God's weakness and suffering. The Bible directs humanity to God's powerlessness and suffering. Only the suffering God can help us. Bonhoeffer understood that as his way of being in the world. The life, teachings, death, and resurrection of Jesus led Bonhoeffer to find God. That was the way he knew and experienced God in his own life, was entering into the depths of the ways of Jesus. This is generations before that Isaiah is writing, saying that we long for a person that's going to lead us out of this darkness into a shining light of a new way. Isaiah was writing to a subjugated people who were in a land of deep darkness. The Assyrian Empire was crushing who they were. And Isaiah wanted them to hear that God sides with the oppressed. Bonhoeffer wants us to know that to do that, we have to enter into relationship and to suffering with God and with God's people. In Isaiah's day, the shadow of this Assyrian Empire cast deep darkness, and that looked like hunger and poverty and crushing desolation. In Bonhoeffer's day, it was the shadow of a Nazi regime. 6 million lives taken. It seems like in moments like that, there is no light. There is no light in those kind of deep, dark lands. And that's how I felt a lot of this week as I read Isaiah and prepared to try to stand right here. And then I got to listen to a young woman who is a Sikh activist and lawyer. She's a movement leader, and she's a prophet. Her name is Valerie Kaur. She started to tell the story of her grandfather, who was Sikh, coming to the United States. And she describes how when he enters, it's his dark skin that makes the white folks around him feel uncertain. And then she talks about some of the white folks who came around him to help him get his paperwork figured out. And then she tells the story of at Christmas Eve this year, she was putting her 2-year-old to bed, and as she did, it started to hit her that the world that her grandfather encountered as a Sikh man coming into this space feels even less dangerous than the world she thinks she's handing to her 2-year-old son. And she was holding at nighttime as he was putting out the cookies and the milk, and he wanted to feel and believe in the magic of a new possibility. She was feeling the dread and the depths of a darkness that she thought she'd left behind. And then she shared these profound words. What if the darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? This young mom stood right there holding her two-year-old. What if the darkness that she was finding herself in isn't the darkness of a tomb, but it's the darkness of the womb? I think that's what Isaiah was looking out at the people and seeing. Seeing God pounding in the earth beneath their feet. Seeing God like pulsing in the bodies around them. Feeling God thrashing to be set free. God was forming them in the darkness that felt sometimes like a tomb, but was the darkness of a womb. And we sang that from the Lord of Light, like a labor of love. We saw it on signs. They tried to bury us. They didn't know we were seeds. Isaiah looked out and knew the people weren't dead. They were being formed. God was preparing to birth them, to birth us into revolutionary love. Once subjugated people being formed in the womb of God as resistance and healing and hope and freedom and justice. And so can we hear today God midwifing us right now? Can you hear that God guiding you through like the breathe, push, breathe, and push? Friends, it's a gift to be in the darkness of God's womb with you and with God, the God who meets us in every experience of hurt, who lights a candle when we can't find a way to do so, and then calls us into a new life of love and healing and hope. Amen.
There's a place, a garden for the young, to laugh and dance in the safety among the shimmering light and the shade of the trees. Still abide and paradise is lost. With darkened hearts we didn't count the cost. Forgot all we left behind. Life picks up speed before you know we hold on for dear life, oh Lord. We're too proud to turn back now. One day it all falls down, it breaks our heart and it breaks our crown. It brings us down to where we see it's gonna be all right. Turn around and come back to the light. And joy will come. Like a bird in the morning sun. And all will be made well once again.